The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, we tackle the Tick. Rodrigo croaks, Steven fanboys for Josie, Ashley goes to hell, and I refuse to read Clean Room in the Dark. Plus, encountering the inevitable end of Invincible, mulling over the melee of Merman, and generally geeking up the joint in our inimitable MSP fashion, it's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights. It's time to meet the something-something Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 692 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for sharing this episode with a friend. And thank you, everyone, who uses that Amazon link over at Major Spoilers. It doesn't cost you anything extra when you use it, but as a show of thanks for sending you their way, Amazon gives us a little back. So keep clicking it and buying whatever you want, whether it be a Tick Omnibus or a television or a new car. All can be found on
Amazon. Television playing the Tick Omnibus, because you can do that now.
Yes, there's Matthew, obviously. And Rodrigo is here.
Hey, guys.
And Ashley is here once again this week. Hi, Ashley.
Oh, hello.
Hey, let's get to some news. We've got three items we could talk about this week. Robert Kirkman is ending Invincible. Deathstroke appears in the new Batman movie. And websites are changing their look and people are freaking out. Let us spin that wheel of destiny and see where we land. I'm going to bet we're not going to be talking about Newsarama or CBR's logo change.
Well, in their defense, those are ugly.
We will be talking about Robert Kirkman is ending Invincible. So a couple of weeks ago, Robert Kirkman sent out an announcement to everyone and basically says, hey, everybody, after 13 years of Invincible, I'm ending the series next year. So at issue 144, it'll be done. It'll be gone. And I'm okay with it. Now back to my Walking Dead work. So, bye, everyone. It may have been a little addition in there by me, but...
Yeah, you may possibly have been editorializing just a teensy bit.
Yeah, so there you go. So what's everyone's reaction to this? My initial reaction is like, oh, man, Invincible was my favorite Robert Kirkman work, and now he's ending it. And so I will be sad.
I basically feel exactly the same because I'm not a zombie person. So Walking Dead is out, and I like Outcast. I like the comic pretty well, but Invincible, even for all of its hyper violence, is just like superhero candy for your eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so fun and it's so easy, and you can read the omnibus in like a plane ride if you really want to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they had said for a long time that they were just going to pass it off to someone. And so the really selfish part of me is like really sad that that didn't happen either, because I just think that world is so interesting. So bummer, but I mean, I get it. Walking Dead makes all the money.
Yeah. I mean, we've only seen three creators on this, right? Robert Kirkman, Corey Walker, and Robert Ottley, or Ryan Ottley.
Ryan Ottley, yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm kind of glad that they've been able to make it 144 issues, or will make it to 144 issues sometimes next year. But Rodrigo, does this news bother you at all?
No, not really. I mean, it makes sense. This is like a superhero story where the creator has that control to be like, it's over. And honestly, I wish that would happen to more superheroes, you know, where somebody could be like, man, oh, man. This sure was a great run of Spider-Man. Let's never write Spider-Man again.
You know,
I know people are like freaking out about it. Like they're like, what? But seriously, some superheroes like should just have like that complete run in which they were awesome and then get set aside for people to do other things.
You know, Invincible kind of started as kind of a tongue-in-cheek look at superhero genre, at least when it was in the early 2000s. Or late 90s, early 2000s. Maybe it has run its course. Maybe he can only pay homage to those different genres and to those different heroes so much before it becomes something that isn't really what it intended to be from the offset. And so maybe it is time to make it in.
Well, and if you read the statement, that's that's kind of his concern, right? His concern is that in the moment that he passes it on, the next creative team might be great. And maybe the next creative team after that might also be great. But eventually, it's going to get to that point where Invincible and a resuscitated character that died for important reasons but is now back hop on a convertible and cruise the United States, like, not actually doing any superheroing, because that's what that creative team decided. Like, people are like, that's not really Invincible. Well, let's call Kirkman at home and see what he thinks about this. He doesn't want that. You know, he's like, this is his only, probably his only means of making, of keeping this work from becoming, you know, any superhero comic during this bad run, like, right, from becoming that Superman or Green Arrow or that run of X-Men you hated. And by you, I mean me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it is creator owned. So you would imagine that he can end it, like you said, whenever he wants.
This way he gets to end it exactly the way he wants.
Exactly where he wants. Mm-hmm. End of an era, Matthew, or just another blip on the highway?
Well, end of an era, depending on how you look at it. I mean, Invincible's been around since 2003, and it did start as part of a whole in kind of a shared universe thing at Image, and none of the rest of that shared universe is around anymore.
Well, what's his name is still there. A dinosaur head, Savage Dragon.
Not part of that same thing, though. Invincible came out with Fire Breather and Noble Causes and one other book that I can't remember that I think was from the guy who did Shadowhawk in 2003. And all of those other books have gone by the wayside. None of them have come anywhere near 100 issues, much less 144. I think that, yeah, it is the end of an era, but here's the thing that you have to think about. Invincible is built on ignoring or inverting the rules of superhero comics. Invincible is the book where they introduced the Justice League of America, sort of, kind of, maybe, and then had them murdered on panel by the protagonist's father 5 seconds later.
Spoilers.
Ah, please. 15-year-old spoilers. The thing about Invincible is they've built that whole book on doing not what all the other superhero books do. And the one thing that the vast majority of superhero books never do is end. So I think that this is probably the perfect way for Invincible to go out. It's going out the way it went, probably with big piles of blood and people with their arms ripped off and probably a pregnant woman getting stabbed for some reason.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this? Is this, Ashley, you seem to be the most upset about this, but are you kind of glad that you will then be able to, in 10 years, go back and pick up 3 omnibus editions and have the entire Invincible run right there in your reading lap, so that when you're riding on your private jet, you can just crack it open anytime?
I already have 2 of them, so.
Private jets? Wow. Can I ride?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're doing pretty good for yourself.
Nailed
it. Good job.
No, I have 2 of the omnibus already. I do appreciate it from an artistic standpoint, but I'm a greedy millennial, so neener, 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 I'm sad and I want more.
You know, I know this book, I know it comes out monthly, but it seems like it doesn't come out as regularly
not always.
As it should. But this is one that I always do look forward to, even though I may skip like 2 or 3 months and then grab a bunch of them all at once and read them. This was really kind of a breath of fresh air when I first picked up I think Image sent me the first omnibus in like 2006 or 7. And I read that in one sitting and I was like, holy cow, this is like the greatest thing I've read in such a long time. It's like a breath of fresh air considering what's going on at all the other publishers. And it seems like, even though Invincible riffs on things going on at the other publishers, it seems like other publishers have picked up on things that he is doing and incorporated them into their comics, which just creates this really weird circle of chaos.
It's a book that's ahead of trends with regularity, and it's fascinating to see it. And I don't honestly think it's people ripping off Kirkman. I think it's the way Kirkman works, because if you read his books, he's generally the guy telling the story that you're going to see in a big crossover a year or two down the line. And, you know, it's not that I'm not upset about Invincible getting canned. It's just that the first book that I really got heartbroken about getting canceled was in 1986. So, you know, that's 30 years ago. I've got this big scar tissue over my comic book heart at this point. So I will miss Invincible. I'll certainly miss, you know, guys like Best Tiger and those lunatic moments where, you know, incredibly stupid stuff happens. And you know what I'll miss more than anything? I'll miss Adam Eve turning things into other things with big gouts of pink flame. But the back issues are always there. And you'll have a complete story to read if and when you decide to go back and read it. So really, what you had with Invincible will always be there. Not like my terrible ex, who I don't know where she is.
I'm going to also miss, changing the subject abruptly and completely, you two doing your dueling reviews on Invincible, because I feel like especially when Invincible's not coming out with any sort of regularity, mm-hmm. you guys always pick it up because it's been two or three months and you feel okay circling back around to it. Yeah. And those are always some of my favorite dueling reviews. So I'm going to be sad that those will go away.
Yeah.
Well, we will make sure and dueling review 144.
We will do 144 and do a dueling review.
When it comes out in 2021.
It's supposed to, supposedly, according to Kirkman, it is supposed to come out in November of next year. So we've got essentially 12 issues to go. And he said it.
Well, 130 just came out, so there's 14 yet to print.
Right. So that would be November of next year, October, November, and then 12 would be November again. So that is the, it's going to be a 12-part epic. The End of All Things is what it's going to be called. And
that's Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. I wonder if it's
that's
just going
right to,
I wonder if it will end with a giant universe explosion.
Oh, I hope so.
Or if it will end with, Mark and Adam Eve and their daughter, right? Just walking off into the sunset together.
It should end with just a hard reboot where, like, you wind up on, like, New Earth, but you don't know that you're on New Earth until the last page.
No, Savage Dragon did that, like, three times. No, what I really hope happens is, remember those first pages of Invincible number one where Mark discovers his powers mm-hmm. and comes home, says, oh, my God, I got my powers? Invincible 144 should end with Terra discovering her powers, coming home to mom and dad and going, oh, my God, I got my powers. And then just ending there, because that's where the book started.
Oh,
was a
cool
teenager coming home to Super Dad and saying, Super Dad, I'm now Super 2.
And but, then Super Dad know, tries to kill him in the next issue.
Well, thank
and
God
for the next
the
15
issue.
Years.
we won't have to see Mark fighting his daughter. Yeah. Hopefully she'll kick him in the head.
Poor Mark, though. He's been kicked in the head a lot.
And if it's Ryan Ottley doing the artwork, then his head will be flying off with an eyeball
just
popping out.
Blood,
yeah,
blood,
yeah.
Yeah. Blood. Massive amounts
you
of red.
Some people, yeah. Have you ever done like background fills on art where they draw in little things and they put in the thing that says fill this with the blacks? They do that with red on Invincible. It's just like fill the whole panel with red, just blood everywhere.
All right, the countdown begins to the End of All Things. We will keep you up to date here on Major Spoilers. And you can check out these stories and a whole lot more, except for the whole thing about the website's changing and people are freaking out about it, because apparently everyone who's talking about comics journalism are more focusing on the websites getting a change than anything else. But there you go. You can go look for those silly stories yourself. But if you want to take a look at that Deathstroke image that Ben Affleck leaked, we've got it over there at majorspoilers.com. While you're over there, check out a monthly article from our friend Rand he's one half of Ookla the Mock. He's got a new Random Access Memory article that is up where he takes a look at 40 years worth of comics based on the month that this is. So you just got to take a look. This month is the August and 40 years worth of comics that influenced him. And then next month he'll do it all over again. So it's all over there at majorspoilers.com. Let us do some reviews. Matthew, why don't you start us off with Clean Room number 11, since I believe it came out last week and everyone is still freaking out about it.
Oh my God, Clean Room is freaking.
So what is Clean Room is about, first of all? Because I don't think
Clean
we've
Room
reviewed it on this show before.
I believe I hit on one of them, maybe one or two, like a million years ago. Basically, Clean Room is a complicated story, but our protagonist, our central character, is a woman named Chloe. Chloe's boyfriend killed himself because of a self-help guru, that's a good word, guru, named Astrid Mueller. And Astrid runs a huge organization that has clean rooms, which allow you to deal with your neuroses and psychoses by putting you in a room where they literally come to life.
Your neuroses.
So that's bad.
Yeah, that sounds
literally
horrific.
Yes. That is horrific, and it's bad. And there's a lot of death and a lot of blood and a lot of terrible people doing terrible things. And, of course, at least one quasi-demonic presence from the great beyond. So in this issue, Astrid, who has now somehow become a co-tagonist, is that what you call someone who's also part of it, a tritagonist, perhaps? Astrid has been shot by her brother and is in the mountains trying to recover. Meanwhile, Chloe has been left in charge of the organization. Unfortunately, the people that she's over don't realize that. And then there's some shooting. And there's some really, really bad people who are trying to take over the entire company and use the clean room for super nefarious purposes. Which is interesting because the first five issues is now somehow turned around and there's a worse villain that's getting ready to make her look like a piker. Which I really kind of love about this book. You never know who is actually evil, and nobody is always on the same side. And there's this moment where you realize kind of they're all evil. It's also really interesting. And this issue ends three different plot lines come together. Has gotten out of the box, and in a desperate attempt to save herself, Chloe has told it to do something, and then she tells it to stop. It says no, and then we fade to black, and please don't read this book in the dark. This book is gorgeous, visually amazing. The artist is John Davis Hunt, and he has this ability to draw something that looks completely mundane and perfectly normal. It looks like just a corporate boardroom, but there's something around the edges that just looks like it's all teeming with Cthulian monstrosities. There's something about every panel that is just really stressful to look at in all of the best and all of the worst ways. And reading this book will raise your blood pressure. I have physical proof. But the thing that ties it all together is that sense that pretty much everything that can go wrong is probably going to, and nobody is entirely pure of motive, and that bad things are going to happen, and they seem to be going to keep happening. They're just going to spiral out of control until we all die. And that's kind of the book. Three and a half slices of meatloaf. I kind of love it. I really do. I'm not always attracted to something that feels, I don't know if nihilistic is the right sort of thought process, but it's definitely not a book for the faint of heart, but it is really exciting and really awful all at once. So I do recommend it.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Matthew, for that. Ashley, you have a movie for us, right?
I have a full-length feature film for you.
All right.
It is of your more independent variety. It is Hell and High Water, which has been getting a lot of critical acclaim. I went to go see at the movie theaters. It stars Chris Pine and your angel there, Ben Foster, with the impossibly low pants. I think he was also in Warcraft, but I don't know if I want to advertise that on his behalf or not. So Hell or High Water is a movie kind of like Cop Car or Wet Hot American Summer. It's like a bottle episode, but a whole movie. It is set in Texas. They did not shoot in Texas, but it is all set around these small little towns that you basically don't have to pay anyone to film in because nobody ever shoots their movie there. And it just tells a story about these guys and their lives. And so Chris Pine and Ben Foster are brothers. And one of them just got out of jail and does sort of nefarious things. And the other one has been taking care of their mother who recently passed and their estate, which they can't afford to pay off their family farm. So they decide together that the way they're going to deal with their money problems is to rob banks. And that's basically, without spoiling anything, what the movie's about. It's kind of about these morally ambiguous dudes doing this morally ambiguous thing, but it does kind of brush up against the question, like, you know, would you steal a loaf of bread to, you know, feed your starving family? And then one of them is forced to decide whether or not to save the other brother. And I think as a film, it's really well made. It's very beautiful. It feels like a Western in the sense that they hold on a lot of shots of like grass or the sky just to really imbue the environment with as much character and importance as the story or the individual characters. Jeff Bridges plays the marshal who is chasing them, and he's basically just playing Rooster Cogburn. Cogburn?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cogburn.
From your True Grit, he's basically just playing that, but older, and with a more ethnically diverse partner. He's great. Chris Pine is surprisingly great. I really like him when he's not playing I'm the hero guy roles lot more. Like, he's really great in this, and he's really great in Z for Zachariah, which is the same. It's kind of like a dirty guy in the middle of nowhere with emotional problems. Mm-hmm. And it's just really fascinating to watch. And then Ben Foster is really good. I didn't love it with all the fervor that I am seeing people on the internet love it, because I have a hard time with stories where someone's a bad person and you just watch them be a mm-hmm. bad person and that's the story. Like, so I enjoyed the way it was made and the way it was executed, but I was like, but you were a bad person who did a bad thing and then you got what was coming to you, you know, the end. So I think like that's where I kind of struggled with having an incredible experience the way I had an incredible experience watching something like Kubo, for example.
Yep.
And that's me. And I know that's not a lot of people, because I know that Breaking Bad is super popular. And maybe they'll be able to get a little bit more out of this movie than I did. But it's not doing super well in the box office. So like last week, I would really encourage people to go and check out Hell or High Water, because if you're sick of franchises and you're sick of sequels and reboots, this is the kind of filmmaking that's going to change that. And this is going to make better films. So I would really recommend going to see it. Hell or High Water, Sad Guys in Texas, 3 out of 5 slices of meatloaf.
I have heard a lot of great things about this, and I do want to see this. But after seeing Kubo, I don't know if all those people who are claiming that this is the best movie of the year really know what they're talking about. So
for my money, they are incorrect. Kubo's
definitely
epic.
Better. Yeah. Out this week from Archie Comics is Afterlife with Archie number 10. And this book continues to impress. What is this issue about? Well, it's part 5 of the Betty RIP storyline, but we're taking a break and we're looking to see what Josie and the Pussycats are doing during this entire breakdown of society, entire zombie outbreak. Here's the thing, though. This doesn't happen during the events. This takes place before Zombie Night happens, and we get to find out the incredible 100-plus-year history of Josie and the Pussycats. Wait, you didn't know that Josie's around? You didn't know that Josie's been alive since 1906?
What?
You didn't know that Josie's and the Pussycats have gone by many, many different names from the 20s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, 80s, the 90s, and today?
I do now.
You do now, and you'll find out why and how in Afterlife with Archie number 10. It is a fun little diversion story that is kind of melancholy, kind of a little bit depressing. It's going to put a spin on how you view Josie and the Pussycats going forward, at least in this Afterlife with Archie universe. The writing is really solid, as always, from Robert Aguirre-Sacasa, and Francesco Francavilla's art is to die for, and literally in some of these panels, somebody dies. But it is a great story. I recommend picking it up. I think if you look at the preview over at majorspoilers.com, you'll figure out very quickly why they are 100 years old. But I want to save that fun for you to figure out. Go pick up Afterlife with Archie number 10. It's out this week from Archie Comics. Definitely 5 slices of meatloaf for me. So there you go. Rodrigo, you also have a new comic that is out this week.
Yeah. Croak number 1. It is a scary
comics, I think.
I don't remember.
Okay.
Yep, sorry about that. I don't have it in front of me. Yes, Croak number 1 is the story of some friends who go camping, because that never goes wrong, right?
Never
in the history. So, yeah. So three friends go camping and they set up camp in the woods, and then scary stuff starts to happen. Croak is an interesting book because it sets up from the beginning that there's this like supernatural stuff going on, and then something happens between the characters that is like 1,000 times more interesting than the supernatural stuff. And I just kind of wanted to follow that. So like this like really serious thing happens between the three friends, and I don't want to spoil it. And then the last panel is the panel is a reveal of a monster. But it's just not as impactful as what actually happens between the characters.
Mm.
You know, it's just like, oh, and also monsters, you know, I don't know. It's kind of hard to tell if something supernatural triggers what happens between the characters.
Okay.
Or if it was just kind of a prank gone wrong. Yeah, it's interesting. The art is good. You can tell who everybody is. You can tell that they're in the spooky woods. The spooky stuff looks spooky. I'm a fan of that.
This isn't one of those weird morality plays about save your virginity, is it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I wish. No virginities are questioned in this book from what I've read. Yeah. So, it's interesting, but it's weird that maybe future issues will bring the events together, but to me, I don't know. It's kind of like, it's like the interactions between the characters are interesting, and then also they're like, and then this scary stuff is gonna happen to them, but I'm like, shh, hang on, monster. I want to see how this plays out, monster. Altogether, I'll give it 2.5 slices of meatloaf. Mm. It's not bad. It's weirdly, it's like focusing on an aspect of the story that I'm not that interested in. So, maybe if these things are brought together in later issues, then I'll be more interested.
Very cool. Thank you, Rodrigo. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Matthew, for your reviews. And listeners, if you're looking for more reviews, of course, you know where to head, majorspoilers.com. Also at majorspoilers.com, you will find the fascinating, the always exciting, the often controversial Major Spoilers Poll of the Week. Poll of the Week. Poll. We go back into the fisticuffs this week, and Silver Gray writes in and says, I want to know who would win in a fight between Aquaman and Namor. Matthew, why don't we start with you? Who's going to win in a fight, Aquaman or Namor? Fascinating. Very, very fascinating. Oh, well, thank you for that. Rodrigo, how about we check in with you? Who would win in a fight, Aquaman or Namor?
Are you sure we haven't done this poll before?
That's what it I feels keep like thinking, but this. I look back like almost a year and I don't see it in there anywhere. So maybe we did do this a long time ago and it's circulated back around again. But I'm sure everyone has a different opinion a second time around.
So I think that Namor would win.
And why do you say that?
Because Namor has like little wings on his feet.
Oh, okay.
And he has the power to be super naked.
Mm-hmm.
And also he punches a guy that's on fire like very regularly.
Yeah.
And then a guy who's made of rocks very regularly. And Aquaman does those things too, but he just doesn't have that frequency, you know. It's just like rock guy on fire guy just pretty much every day. Aquaman is just not practicing, not putting in the time the way that Namor is.
All right.
Altogether, as far as kings of the underwater realm go, I'd probably give it to Namor.
Well, if we did do this poll before, Ashley certainly hasn't weighed in. Mm-hmm. Ashley, who's going to win, Aquaman or Namor?
Namor is kind of a scoundrel, you know, and he's a good plotter. He once created a movie studio to try and trick Sue Storm into marrying him. However, Aquaman recently got this real badass facelift in the form of Jason Momoa. So I have a feeling that if the Jason Momoa, like Morrison 90s hook hand Aquaman, he could probably, through sheer force of will, take down Namor. But it's kind of a Batman Superman thing. If Namor has the time to plot and execute a ridiculous plot, he might have the upper hand. And just to be contrarian, and because everybody thinks that I'm paid off by DC anyway, I'll say Aquaman.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm also going to go with Aquaman because I'm going to say Namor is part fish and Aquaman can control fish. So therefore, Aquaman can control Namor.
Ooh.
And the fight will end up with him saying, "Why are you punching yourself in the face, Namor? Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself?" So Aquaman for me. Let's see. What do we have in the comments section? I love both of these characters, says Tim. Let's see.
I think besides, I'm back. Am I back?
Oh, I guess you are. He says he's going to vote for Namor on respect to the publisher the respect that the publisher has given him over the years. So there you go. Zarin Black says there's a few problems that can be solved by summoning a bigger fish. Russ Cat says Imperius Rex, which means Namor. Hip Hop Head says, similar to Tim, he has a spot for both. However, Namor has Mad Game. How many times has he pushed up on Sue Storm right in front of Reed Richards? Didn't she go live with him under the water? Has Aquaman convinced an air breather to live underwater with him? Oh, so many people weighing in this week. There's a lot of people weighing in this week. I love seeing all the comments. Of course, listeners, you can head over to MajorSpoilers.com. You can cast your vote in the poll of the week and share your comments. Matthew, where does everyone sit right now in the Major Spoilers poll of the week?
Right now, with 56 votes in the bag, 57% of them leaning towards Aquaman, 43% Namor, so a difference of, I don't know, like three votes, something like that?
Three votes can change this either
something
way.
Something like that.
Yes. All right. Thank you for that, everyone.
Yeah, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yep. Head over to Major Spoilers Poll of the Week, and while you are over there, if you're looking for a really cool pair of headphones, you want to check out some Tweaked Audio headphones. So many different styles, so many different colors. TweakedAudio.com is the place to go. The code that you want to use on checkout is major, and you will get 33% off the price. Thank you, Tweaked Audio, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast. So last week, the Tick, or it was actually more like a week and a half ago, the Tick debuted on Amazon. This is what, the third incarnation of a live-action Tick or animated Tick. So we had the animated Tick series. We had the live action series that was on Fox, and now we have an Amazon series. There's something about the Tick that everyone seems to think that there's money to be made there. And so this week I thought we would take a look at the Tick, the complete Edlund edition. That's really hard to find, unless, of course, you have the issues when they originally came out. And if you did, wow, because most of us got it when they did the second or third printings back in the 90s.
Mine are all seventh printings.
Oh, really? I think I have one that is a first printing. And then most of mine are third, or I've got three of them that are third printings and four of them that are seventh printings.
I had a first printing number two that I sold to the shop for like $40 at one point.
So what is it? What is it, Ashley, about the Tick that makes him something that people want to pay attention to, even though so many people have never heard of this character?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, first of all, Ben Edlund created this character when he was 18 and then managed to turn him into a giant franchise. So you have to respect that. I had never read the comics before, although the cartoon was out when I was an actual child, which watching the Tick as an actual child is a very confusing experience because you just can't understand like the level of parody that's going on, and you're like, they're just all kind of crappy superheroes. But so going back and reading the comic, it looks very, you know, cartoony. Like, that's how I would describe the art style.
Right.
It's very kinetic, and there's not a ton of words on the page. You can read I think it's like 36 pages, probably like 30 or so pages of actual shenanigans. You could read it very quickly. It feels kinetic and it feels like it should be on screen.
Right.
And it's pretty funny. So I just think it's the right balance between all of these things. And then with I mean, Clark Kent is literally a character in this series. And I don't know how they slipped that past copyright. Because it was the 90s.
It's obvious.
It's Clark Oppenheimer.
He's Clark Oppenheimer.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He's not Clark Kent. And he works for the Daily Eric. World or whatever it is. And his boss isn't That's Perry right. White. It's Perry
The Weekly
Beige.
World
Perry,
Bugle.
Perry Beige.
Yes. And instead of Jimmy, it's Billy.
But all of those things, like, they're so funny to the nerds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can harness that, especially now, like, I understand why the Fox show didn't succeed. But I really think
action?
that show. Yeah. I really think that show, if it was being done right now, I think it would do very, very well. I just think it dropped in the wrong climate. I think there's a lot of stuff to mine there, but I also think that, and this is the fault that a lot of things that are literary and then get adapted to the screen, it's not like too smart for its own good.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be that, like, if you, everyone knows who Superman is, so like you get the joke.
Mm-hmm.
You may not know the Perry White joke, although a lot of people now can name check that character because of Smallville and Man of Steel. I think the balance that it strikes is one of the best. You know, we talked about Invincible a little bit earlier. Invincible does the same mm-hmm. thing, but with a much more serious lens thrown on top of their storytelling.
Right. This is straight up parody and spoof when it comes to it, even to the point where if you're someone that did grow up in the 80s and 90s reading comic books, then a lot of this stuff, when Elektra shows up, wow, there's Elektra. When Paul the Samurai shows up, you know, you've got a little Gru thing, or you've got a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles mm-hmm. thing going on. You've got Evil Ernie, a ripoff in there as well. It's just, hey, let's make fun of as much stuff as we can through the lens of this guy that may or may not be all with it. I mean, Rodrigo, he looks through a Viewmaster to spot evil.
Yeah, it's part of his secret techniques to spot evil.
Well, and he's got a hypnotic tie, you know, so people can't figure out his secret identity.
Right. He's also sometimes in an insane asylum.
Right. So that's really kind of an interesting thing that by the time you hit issue 10 or something, you get this notion that he may not be all with it because he's talked about being inside of an insane asylum on more than one occasion, not voluntarily.
Yes, correct. There's like flashbacks to it. Much later on, Arthur brings, or Arthur's neighbor, I guess, brings it up, and that Arthur should have some help, and she name checks a specific location, an actual hospital, and Tig is like, boo, boring, don't go there, I've been there.
Yeah. You know, what's really funny, for those of you that do get a chance to ever read this, there is a scene when Arthur and the Tick first team up, and Arthur is like, hey, I just got this flying moth suit on auction. He's like, well, I want to be your sidekick. How about you come back to my apartment? And the scene that we see in Arthur's apartment where Tick is like, ooh, this is your secret headquarters, right? That scene is adapted directly into the Amazon pilot, where the mm-hmm. Tick shows up in Arthur's apartment. Is like, oh, do I pull this? Do I, you know, spin this? Where is your secret lair located? Right out of the comic book, which I thought was really kind of a nice touch. Matthew, what are some things that people should know about the history of the Tick? You know, how did it get started? Where did Edlund come up with this stuff?
I believe the Tick actually started as part of a sales brochure for his comic business.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was just basically doodling and doodling and doodling, and somehow it turned into an adventure, and that turned into the first issue, which ridiculously everybody seemed to love. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's kind of ridiculous, because it feels a little bit like, you know, of roughly the same time period, a little bit earlier, uh-huh. we got something similar for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is it about the ninjas? Why are there so many ninjas running around in this book?
Well, it's from the 80s. Ninjas were everywhere in the 80s.
Yeah.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it really seems to me that this first arc of the Tick is just a directly aimed rocket propelled grenade at
DC.
At Daredevil.
Oh, right.
Like, yeah. Is it Morrison's Miller, Daredevil? At Frank Miller.
Frank Miller's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With Oedipus and the ninjas and the fat leader of all the ninjas.
Oh, yeah. It's I mean, DC, Marvel, Image, and who was doing, Image wasn't around, who was doing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Mirage,
yeah. I mean, he just pokes fun at all of them and really doesn't care. And I think that's why I think it works so well, is because if you are reading comics, and let's face it, everything that he's poking fun of, everyone was reading at that time, it was instantly relatable and easy to pick up. And I remember picking up my first issue, and it wasn't even the number one issue, but it was like 88, 89. And I picked up maybe issue 4. It's the one that had the start of the Elektra arc in it.
Three.
And I was just like, wow, this is really funny. Who is this guy? And then it took me like a full year later before I found another comic book store that had the first 3 issues and then also had, or the first 2 issues, and then also had issues 4 and 5 with the promise that another one was coming, quote unquote, soon. Which is, you
and
know,
of
again,
course, the issue starts with, my God, I dreamed that I didn't exist for 8 months.
That's going into what, issue 12 or something like that?
Yeah, 10 or 11, yeah.
And this book was notoriously delayed. It was just basically whenever I get around to it kind of stuff.
Yeah. A lot of books from the black and white boom of the 80s were like that, though. Mm-hmm. And
they were hard to find.
And Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was the same way. It was one of those things where the fans waited because the quality was there. And, you know, over the course of the decade, some of these books put out 4, 5, 10 issues. Mm-hmm. By the time we were getting to the 3rd and 4th and 5th printings, it's 1996. Mm-hmm. The book's been around for 10 years and there's 8 issues of it to read. So,
yeah. And then, of course, all of it was collected into a paperback, or at least maybe the first 6 issues were collected into a paperback. I don't remember all the collections that are out there, but I do know that I have besides the single issues, I have a collected edition somewhere. Also, I don't know if I still have my Tick poster hanging around, but the other thing that appears in the first couple of issues is how to draw the Tick. First, draw a circle, then draw a line, and then draw the Tick.
Holding the circle with the line through it.
Now, something, I don't know if you guys were reading the letters columns in these issues, but there is something, and I don't know how this happened, but Scott Kurtz gets name-checked in the Tick because apparently when he was working at his school newspaper, he had a gag very similar to that, or almost exactly, and I don't know if he was homaging the Tick or what, but I shouted out to Kurtz. I was like, hey, I'm reading the Tick today, and your name pops up. And he's, yes, that letter column caused a lot of fuss at my college newspaper with my editor. Ha ha, is what he says on that. So it was just really weird to see Scott Kurtz's name pop up and go, wow, that kind of gives you perspective on both where the Tick was at the time and where Kurtz was at the time and where they are today. So I thought that was kind of interesting and fun to read. Now, I didn't read all the other letter columns because some of it gets kind of long and drawn out.
Yeah, the letter columns are 4 and 5 pages in some of these issues.
Got to fill it up. Ashley, what's your favorite part of this Tick run?
I really like the first issue when you get to see that he is both utterly capable and incapable as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I just think the first issue is really strong because it's so funny and it drops you in media res, but not in a confusing way. Just like, don't worry, you'll catch up. There's not that much to it.
So do you think then that the series went down the longer it went? I mean, by the time Arthur shows up, is it as funny as the first? When a sidekick first appears or not?
I didn't mean it like that. I just think that was the issue that I got the most enjoyment out of.
Okay.
Like Arthur's a great character and I enjoy their dynamic together. I think that you could have continued the comic series longer and there might have been some really exciting stuff that came out of it. I just was so impressed with that first issue because, frankly, I expected it to be not very good, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel very much, Rodrigo, like an early 80s indie comic in the black and white vein, but it really holds its own, and sadly, it only went the 13 issues.
Yeah, it is just like, it's not just the feel of it, but it's like so many things during that time in that black and white thing. It starts out as satire and then kind of becomes its own thing.
Right.
It's like, oh, well, people like this. Okay, well, let's write a story. And personally, I feel that The Tick really comes into it. So The Tick as a piece really comes into its own around that like issue six, when like all of the ninja stuff is over.
Mm-hmm.
And we start getting into basically making fun of superheroes in broader terms, exploring, yes, you know, a superhero that pays the supervillain to wreak havoc so he can beat him,
mm-hmm,
you know. And then we start getting into the stuff with like Chairface and all, like basically when The Tick starts kind of musing on superheroes rather than really taking a look at specific things and being like, now we're making fun of Superman. Now we're making fun of Daredevil. Like it really just begins to expand and become absurd in a much more enjoyable way.
Yeah. And I think once they leave the city, which is never named, and they head to New York and they find it just littered with superheroes, it does become a lot more fun. Although I could, the trip where they make the stop in the crazy town, the crazy farm town.
Yeah.
Probably not as exciting, but by the time they hit New York and they run into Chairface Chippendale, then you're like, holy crap, anyone who's seen the animated series knows exactly where this came from. This was a direct adaptation of a story from the comics and not something that they created for the animated series. So I like seeing that in all these iterations that we're seeing of The Tick, that they are saying, hey, we're not totally rewriting the history of this character. We're actually incorporating stuff from the comics. We're trying to be faithful in many different ways, maybe not always, but as many ways as they can. And I just kind of dig that. And you're right. By the time they get out of the ninja phase and into, you know, the anti-Tick, or, you know, the other guy that owns the name of the Tick, it gets kind of
Barry,
crazy.
Barry.
Yeah. What did you think of the other Tick, Matthew, and this whole idea of superheroes with the same names and who owns the copyright, and we must fight for ownership of the name?
The Tick Barry interaction has long been one of the more entertaining bits of these early issues for me, simply because it comes down to mostly because the other heroes are rooting for the Tick to beat up Barry, who was called the Tick because Barry's a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, he's stepped into this world where he should be out of his depth and these people should be standing behind him, Barry's just a jerk. And of course, Barry, I think the recent Tick series from 2012, 2013 still has Barry in it. Barry's still naked, by the way, because he lost his name and costume. So he's just wandering around with no pants on because, well, Barry's insane. But it's something that I kept reading and remembering the way it was done in the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love the way it was done in the cartoon, and the way it's done here isn't exactly the way it was done in the cartoon. And my brain has conflated them all into one story. Yeah, so I'm oh, that's different than I remember.
Yeah. Were you ever expecting in this run, Rodrigo, for American Maid to show up, or for the urchin? What was his name? Urchin?
Sewer urchin.
To make an appearance.
Definitely. I really expected them to. I figured at some point they would, and it just kind of came and went, you know. Which is again interesting because I watched the cartoon, and then I watched the Warburton Tick, and I was like, there was so much about it that I didn't like. And part of that was that it wasn't like the cartoon. And because I had skimmed through the comics before, you know, I'd read like one or two issues because honestly, back in the day, they were hard to find.
Yeah.
They probably still are.
I assumed that the cartoon was a much more faithful adaptation. And I was full of indignant nerd rage at the fact that, you know, Deflator Mouse had been changed or whatever. And it's like, well, it's just like such a tiny thing in the cartoon to begin with. Some of these characters aren't even there in the comic, you know, so it's like, you know, in retrospect, it's like, yeah, sure, whatever, do whatever you want with the Tick. There's only 15 issues of it, right?
A 13, I think. Yeah.
13, sure.
So is this...
I don't think the 13th was actually ever done. Ben Edlund has been saying for years that he was going to do it, and they put out one that was not actually Ben Edlund's ending, but I cannot end the story.
Okay. Is this an example? Is the Tick a great example or just an example of a character that has become bigger than his comic book? and I mean that by look at well, we have like three or four seasons of the animated show. We got 9 episodes of a live action show. Amazon is doing it more. There were toys. There's action figures of the Tick you can get. And it's 12 or 13 issues long. And he seems to be popular enough that people recognize it compared to Batman, which has been around forever. And of course, more people would know who Batman is. But for someone that only had, you know, a dozen issues or so, Tick seems to be doing okay for himself. Ashley, what do you think?
I think definitely. I think the cartoon is the main reason why the Tick is as relevant and as recognizable as he is. Plus, he has a really good look. Like, it's a stupid concept of blue Tick. Mm-hmm. But it's such a clever design and it's so striking. And I think that's why it stays in people's minds. It's the Matt Groening rule with The Simpsons that if you turn the lights out, you have to be able to recognize all of the characters by their silhouette. And the Tick definitely fits that bill. And not a lot of heroes do anymore because they're all just a Superman analog, really. I think the Warburton show and the fact that it's been on Netflix for about a gazillion years until Amazon bought all the rights to it, it has helped because it is a really culty thing now, you know, to go and watch that.
Matthew, what do you think?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, the Tick is not popular because of this comic book any more than the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are worldwide sensations because of the Mirage comic. This is the source material, but in, you know, as I said, in many ways, I remember the stories being done differently and subjectively better in other media. And that's a good thing, and that is a bad thing. I mean, I think American Made and Sewer Urchin and Deflator Mouse are only in the cartoon.
Yes.
Because when they did the live action version, American Made and Deflator Mouse got
the rights were all tied up. Which is why, like, we got Batman Well, who I actually like a lot better.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, some of it is good. Captain Liberty, I felt, was just pretty bland because American Made is one of those once in a lifetime stupid concepts where you're like, you know, this is just dumb enough to work. But yeah, this is the origin of the Tick, but it's like that first year of Batman. If you go back and read the DC archives, those stories aren't really indicative of much of nothing. They aren't anything more than standard Golden Age stories. And they're not necessarily even, there are some points where Jerry Robinson's plotting gets really clever, but they're not necessarily big standouts among DC books of that era. It's later on, once that starts getting built up and once that mythology builds up and people start doing the alternate takes and people start saying, what if the character did this? And here's a little bit more, and here's a Batmobile, and here's a kid who follows him around, and a creepy clown who lives in his basement. That's where you get your Batman.
Robin's in the first year.
Robin's in 1940.
2 years later, yeah.
Oh, there you go. My mistake.
Well, you're good.
What doesn't work in this series, Rodrigo? Is there something that that turned you off?
Again, you know, we keep running across, especially comics in the 90s and 80s and 90s, and it's like sudden weird homophobia, like out of nowhere. Right,
the gay panic sequence was just like wrong. Bad.
And it's like someone like the Tick, who is like so deeply delusional to begin with, so disconnected with society, would have such a like socially reinforced like trauma, you know, like kind of nonsense fear. It just shows you how deeply ingrained that it really still is, but definitely how innocuous it was in the culture that we just cannot get away from it. You know, it's like anything that you go into probably prior to the last few years, you are very likely to just, you know, turn a page and find a panel in which characters are, you know, weirdly homophobic.
Mm-hmm. I find that of television shows, even into the 90s as well, it can be very startling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's
Go ahead, Matthew.
There are a couple of plot point moments where there's a little too much reference or homage to specific stories, to the point where, and you know, I don't say this lightly and I don't say this to make myself sound cool, but when you're making plot references that I'm not getting and I go look them up and I realize these are whole plot references to things, that's based on a specific level of 1986 reader information. That, I mean, that's part of that zeitgeist of comic book readers in that era. So if you start looking at issue 3, you're not just seeing references to Elektra in Oedipus. You're seeing panels that are intentionally designed to remind you of some of those Frank Miller Elektra stories and mm-hmm. arcs. And it's just, it's something where it's weird. And then I was also off put by Oedipus with the whole thing about my stepmother could get killed. What was that?
Because she didn't like her stepmother.
Well, I don't like my stepfather, but I didn't wish him dead.
I think one drawback for me was the art. And again, we're looking at indie art, right? But a lot of times the superheroes, and again, this is commentary, a lot of your big bulky superheroes started to have the same shape. So
yeah, for sure.
Clark Oppenheimer certainly looks a lot like the Tick. And there's one other one. Maybe it's
Red
the same.
Scare.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Where they
somebody
look,
actually Red Scare. That Red Scare could be the Tick's twin brother.
Yeah, well, they both, there's something mentioned about, and this is something that'd be interesting to explore further, but they both mentioned something about being laboratory or in an asylum or some hospital or something to mm-hmm. where there can be that connection made that maybe these two are clones of one another.
Could be.
Yeah. So,
but then you get running guy who runs as fast as 10 fast men.
Yeah, since 10
and he's
fast
got
men.
A real life kind of form.
Yeah. No, I mean, what's the nice thing about the Tick is Edlund's style is so easy to mimic that it's not hard for any of us to sit down and to be able to draw the Tick because it is simple lines, simple forms.
Circle.
What's that? First you draw a circle,
draw
and then you draw the Tick. Yeah. I mean, it's simple lines and simple form. That you don't have to spend a lot of time going in and, you know, putting in 52 different pectoral muscles or, you know, having more muscles on the thigh than are actually in the thigh. So it's nice from that standpoint, but it's also at times kind of looks a little bit alike. Let's see. Matthew, is there anything that you that turned you off about the Tick run?
I think the biggest part of it is I like absurdity, and I think absurdity works. I think absurdity is good, but there are points in this story where the absurdity is like everything mm-hmm. for half an issue or a whole issue or a couple of arcs. And there are moments where it's totally funny, but then there's also that moment where just ridiculous things are happening and it doesn't feel like we're going anywhere. And then suddenly Chainsaw Vigilante comes along and breaks his chainsaw on the Tick's privates, which... Another joke that I didn't remember from previous readings.
Yeah.
But I think what it really comes down to is the downside of it is that it has aged well, but the parts of it that haven't aged well have really, really aged poorly.
Yeah.
Ashley, and the absurdity is kind of a problem.
Were there some off-putting moments for you, Ashley, in this?
I mean, the homophobia was probably the thing that I found like the most off-putting. I don't mind the fact that it's super like 80s, 90s indie comic. I actually have a lot of respect for the fact that Ben Edlund just made this comic. Like, that's really cool. I don't have that level of dedication or fearlessness. Like, when you look at the art, sometimes people have what I like to call jello faces, where they're trying to give them character, but it mostly just looks like they sculpted something too much. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are faces that get copied or there are body types that get copied, but it almost enhances this weird, stupid world that you're living in mm-hmm. because the only thing that matters is the Tick. and he's the most unique thing on the page. I mean, one of the, I guess if I was going to pick out a negative, I wouldn't say it has the greatest ending and wrap up of all time.
Right.
But again, when you know the fact that it's basically unfinished. So if you end reading at issue 12, if you know that that's what your experience is going to be going in, then it's not as jarring. But when you're trying to look at it as some kind of like magnum opus, I mean, there's no ending to it. And that's sort of sudden, comes upon you suddenly. But I don't have a lot of negative criticism for the Tick. It's mostly just fun.
So that brings up a good question. Would you want to see this series continued? Now, there was a book in 97 called The Tick Mighty Blue Justice, which was not created by Edlund, but was supposed to be as a tie-in to the animated series. Would you guys be interested in seeing The Tick come back in a monthly form? Would you read those issues, especially now that Invincible is leaving us in the next 14 months?
Totally. And anyone can call me at any time.
When they were putting out that last Tick series, Widget and I were reading it. And again, this was like, I want to say 2012, 2013. They did maybe 12, 15 issues. And again, that may be the magic number. But yes, in as much as, and this is going to sound terrible, the Tick never lasts more than 10 or 12 issues at a time. So it never outstays its welcome. So I'd be willing to add it to a metaphorical pull list right now, because I figure 6 months from now, it'll stop coming out and we'll get another, you know, version of it that comes around here in a little bit. So
any other final thoughts on the Tick?
I think that the Tick series has like appeared and it resurfaces and it gives something to us. You know, the Tick is maybe that hero that we have been clamoring for as the movies turn darker and ridiculous. You know, the Tick was kind of a response to the, like, the hero who is in his own head, who is like, oh, the city cries for me. And we are seeing this stuff again in the movies. So maybe this new Tick series is what is that response. It's like naturally, like actual Ticks, when all this blood bubbles to the surface, it just shows up.
Have you guys had a chance, for those of you that didn't watch it before, have you had a chance to watch the pilot yet?
No.
No? Rodrigo, have you watched the pilot?
I didn't. Yeah. I just watched the trailer for it. I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it.
Cool. Matthew, final thoughts and recommendation on The Tick.
The Tick, among comedy superhero books, is kind of unique. And part of that is the fact that it's funny more often than not. And even when it's not funny, it's vaguely amusing. And it doesn't necessarily lean too hard on the same. No, I shouldn't say that, because it is the same dumb joke, but it's the same dumb joke done in a way that's always kind of refreshing and doesn't necessarily overstay its welcome. These 12, 13, whatever it is, issues are meandering, and there are points where they feel a little pointless, but the read, the journey is worth it. Even if you don't end up anywhere but like the Gas and Sip in Shermer, Ohio, sometimes the journey is worth it. And this is interesting just to see how fat Arthur starts out.
Yeah.
And then seeing Arthur get smaller and smaller and smaller as the series goes on. So that's fun. You have to give him credit for sustained weight loss.
There you go. I'm going to say that this is a fun read. If you can track down the series, I say definitely pick it up and read it. It is definitely a look back into a time period, and but it still holds up today. Ashley, we're going to give you the final word this week on The Tick.
The Tick is definitely worth checking out, especially if you are a fan of either the cartoon, the live action, or the current live action adaptation. I think it's also really great to look at if you're interested in breaking into comics or how people break into comics. It's a really great show of like dedication to your concept, no matter how silly that might seem. It's a lot of fun. Despite some shifting social issues and maybe some weaker art choices at times, but it's way more good than it is bad. And yeah, if you can find it, because it is tragically out of print, I would definitely recommend picking it up.
Yeah. Comixology needs to get on this and get a digital version of this out, like, really, 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 really quick. All right, Matthew, Ashley, Rodrigo, thank you so much for being on this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast. I got some weird hair the other day, and I was like, when was the last time we actually took a week off from the Major Spoilers Podcast? And I stopped when I got back to 2012. Because I had not find a, I could not find a week, and I was like, well, that's 4 years. I mean, I'm not going to go back any further than that. I would probably say the last time we had a week off was maybe 5 or 6 years ago when my youngest was born.
Yeah, you had the flu.
Yeah, I either had the flu or my youngest was born, and we took a break. But at least 4 years of shows on a weekly basis. Holy cow. Thank you guys for making this happen. All of you have been popping in and out over the years. Ashley, our newest addition. Zach was in here for a while. Rob was in here for a while in the last couple of years. And it's been
there
great.
There was Kip.
Yeah, there was Kip.
Yeah, Kip. And Jennifer was here for like 3 episodes.
And the twins.
Yeah, yeah.
The twins. And Cousin Oliver. God, who could forget the twins?
Cousin Oliver, a lot of people didn't care for that. But we
was a jinx, though. He was a total
Here's
jinx.
Here's the thing. That's
he's so the reason why the lost episode was lost, Cousin Oliver.
But that was from a different show. But let's just say that it's been at least 4 years, right? 4 years, 52 weeks a year, right? We never took a holiday off. 52 right. weeks a year times at least four. There's 208 episodes that we have brought to you uninterrupted. I wonder how many other shows do that same thing. And listeners, if you appreciate our long run dedication, I would point you to our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers, where your contribution, your patronage, allows us to continue to do this show uninterrupted for another 4+ years. All thanks to everyone who's signing up over there. Plus, you get things like t-shirts, membership cards, free artwork, all because you become a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers experience. We're going to be back next week to talk the Blue Beetle. Which Blue Beetle? Which volume of the Blue Beetle? Oh, you're just going to have to tune in and find out, because we know that you love comics, and we do too. We will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books, or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.